Namaste and welcome to the Om Som Yoga and Ayurveda podcast.
A space to dive into how we as humans can live more intentional, ethical and sustainable lives.
And how we can come into harmony with ourselves, others and nature in the process.
We share tips to help you cultivate a healthy body, a calm mind and a strong purpose through the traditional Vedic wisdom of yoga and Ayurveda.
My name is Aaron Petty. I'm a yoga teacher, a teacher trainer and yoga therapist, but above all, I'm a student of this great tradition.
And my name is Paige Taylor. I'm a yoga teacher, an Ayurvedic health consultant, advocate for sustainable living and lover of all being.
And on this week's episode, actually, why don't we tell them first about the tea that we're drinking. We'll okay. Do a self-promotion.
All right. Well, right now we're both drinking a cup of my own blend. It's an Ayurvedic blend that I've created to help soothe Pitta dosha. And so it's an incredible blend with some cooling focused herbs like hibiscus, which gives it this beautiful fruity color and
flavor.
It's
kind of like a berry.
It tastes like berries, but it's not berries. Some red clover, as well as a few other herbs, of course, like licorice or marshmallow. And this tea is really good for cooling the body off and helping to lubricate and hydrate the body cool the mind, calm the mind as well.
And it's perfect for us because we are in the middle of summer in Melbourne right now. As mm-hmm. you can see, we're in our sunroom. Mm-hmm. And so this is what we've been serving up probably the most out of all the teas that we have. Mm-hmm. Because of that cooling effect.
Everyone it's so delicious nice as hot. Well.
And it's super luscious.
And so it's available online. Not right this minute that we're probably, recording this, but it should be by the time you're listening to this.
Probably only for people in Australia.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, we'll wait and see.
You could give it a shot.
If you can order from overseas, then you can have the tea.
Anyway, it's a great tea if you have any excess heat in your system, if you're easily irritated by the heat, or if you have any signs of like heartburn, inflammation, all those kind of like pitta dosha related symptoms. So
beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for telling us about that.
No worries. Paige. Thanks for listening.
And also, I just wanted to congratulate you on finishing your Ayurvedic courses.
Thanks so much.
You're officially qualified almost.
Yeah. I basically just have an exam left, a verbal exam with my teacher, which is so not something I'm stressing about. Today I completed my 25 case studies, which has been a big slog, but by far my favorite part of the course. I feel more than confident and more than empowered to start my practice. And I'm so excited to start offering Ayurvedic health consultations, which could look like diet, lifestyle advice, yoga practice, herbs, treatments, et cetera, et cetera. And these consultations will be both in the studio and online. So if you're interested, we'll maybe put a link in the show notes.
Sounds lovely.
I have a question though. Yeah, go for it.
Why is the H silent in herbs?
I think it's an American thing.
Right. But in Australia, we say herbs.
Herbs, yeah.
I feel like I grew up on herbs.
Yeah. Yeah. All my teachers are basically, well, I guess Myra spent a long time in Hawaii. And all my other teachers are from America or India. And most of the time it's herbs. So
yeah. Interesting.
Couldn't really tell you the reason why. I should probably look into that, I guess. All
right. Well, let's make it a little research task. Mm. Cool. And so because of this beautiful transition in Paige's life and this transition into the summer months, we wanted to make this episode of the podcast Ayurveda focused. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a couple of things that we'll look into, the first being Dinacharya,
which is your daily routine,
and the second being Abhyanga.
Yes, specializing in Abhyanga today, focusing on that.
And so what is Abhyanga? Just a brief one.
Well, Abhyanga is just the ritualistic practice of self-oiling your body in some kind of massage with either good quality oil or an Ayurvedic herbal infused oil in specific ways to nourish and calm Vata dosha.
Mm. It's specifically a Vata reducing practice.
I mean, mostly, yeah, but it's it can be balancing for all doshas for sure.
Mm. Cool.
Mm.
All right. So where do you want to kick this off?
I think let's just start by talking about Dinacharya. I think that, I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you've got a bit of an overview of the doshas. But just to recap, we've got Vata dosha. These are just biological humors that we all express and have within us. And we have all three. always. And it's just a matter of the different ratio that these doshas express through us, and also our states of imbalance as to what's the most predominant within us. And most of the time we have two predominant doshas, with a little bit of the third one, but it can also be an even amount of all three.
And what does dosha? What does dosha mean?
It means biological humor, but it also means fault or impurity. And so it's often spoken about as it, you know, your most predominant dosha, meaning the dosha that you have the most in your natural constitution or makeup, is the dosha that's most likely to go out of balance. It's the fault. It's your most predominant fault in terms of the doshas and this concept. Yeah.
Cool.
So within the doshas, we've got Vata dosha, which is comprised of air and ethers. We've got Pitta dosha, which is comprised of fire and water elements. And we've also got Kapha dosha, which is comprised of earth and water elements. And so they're all vastly different. And like I said earlier, they're all present within us at all times. But it just depends on our certain life circumstances, what we're eating, how we're living, what we're doing. As well as times of day and times of season and times of life that can contribute to imbalance.
Cool.
And so it's so important as we begin to not get so hung up on your most predominant dosha, because just knowing that it's always changing. And even within a single day, the times of day change every 4 hours. And so, you know, whilst you may be expressing strong Pitta dosha in a specific time of day, like 4 hours later, it could be a different dosha that's expressing itself through you. And so just noticing how we can move with the rhythms of nature.
I feel like that's just good information right there, that you're not bound to one dosha. I feel like that's a common misconception, is that you're bound to one dosha and you are that dosha. People want to build a personality around a dosha.
It's just like anything.
Yeah, all three affect us at all times and express themselves as different outcomes.
Yeah, and while it can be helpful to understand your most predominant dosha as to like what your tendencies and faults are, like Aaron said, it's not something we need to build a personality around, or it's what you commonly see with the zodiac, like the Western astrology is. I've been seeing a lot of memes about it recently. It's just like, I'm not an empath because I'm a Capricorn. It's because of my like childhood trauma or something like that. But we have this tendency to build a character almost.
I feel like I've definitely seen Instagram pages dedicated to a specific dosha, and it's like memes about a person, personality in a dosha.
And it's nice because it can resonate, and
it's it's like humorous education.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we're human beings and we love to compare and we love to look outwards for validation. And so understanding and having knowledge around Ayurveda and the doshas can be helpful for that sense of validation, or, it's not just me that expresses this, or this is why. But it's also can become like a excuse. And I think that's where the issue lies. It's like, I'm just a little bit overactive in the mind. It's just my Vata dosha. I'm predominant Vata dosha. When it's really like, that is caused by Vata dosha, but it's not something you have to be bound by. Mm. And it's not something that you can't pacify or calm or move out of.
Through Dinacharya.
Yeah, through Dinacharya and through so many other different ways as well.
Yeah.
But as we begin, Dinacharya is one of the most beneficial things you can implement into your life, especially for Vata dosha. And like at the present moment, most of our society is quite Vata dosha provoked. And my teacher speaks about it that, before maybe 20 years ago or so, she rarely saw any Vata provocation in her clients. It was really rare, but through the increased use of screens, of television, of the media, of traveling, of going back and forth everywhere.
I wonder if it's like ever since planes were invented.
Yeah, I wonder when they were invented. They're surely a bit older than that.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like they were only for the rich. Yeah, up until not too long ago.
Anyway, so all these things that are aggravating for Vata dosha, she expresses that it's really only become prevalent in the last 20 years, and that it's rare for her now to see a client that has no Vata aggravation at all.
I remember Pooja saying to us the world is vata.
Yeah, totally.
Everyone is vata.
Yeah, everyone is vata. And the truth of it is, even if there's other doshas involved, vata, I was listening to someone recently, not another teacher that I've been listening to, and she was explaining it, vata is the king of the doshas. And so vata controls all the movement. And so the other doshas like pitta and kapha can't function without vata. And so even if there's other doshas involved, if there's vata or if there's variability or randomness in symptoms or illness, then vata is involved. And because vata is the king of the doshas, you must always try to pacify vata dosha first. And then most of the time, the other doshas will come back into balance.
That's a very interesting thought because of our approach to asana being so intertwined with pranavayus.
Yes, definitely.
And how that's basically a style of practice that pacifies vata dosha and its five manifestations.
100%.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm. Interesting information.
Mm. And that's why it's also so important that we have this asana practice before we do pranayama, and then we have this, you know, important pranayama practice, and that we always do meditation after pranayama, and that pranayama should not necessarily be done without meditation afterwards.
Mm.
Mm.
Interesting.
Because it works with the pranas. It works with the subcategories of vata dosha.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's interesting.
And the meditation grounds.
Mm. And soothes and lets it settle, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's
well,
just a place for integration.
That's interesting because you're right. It's like pranayama is getting things moving. Like breathing
yeah.
is moving.
Yeah.
And if you work with the breath in any kind of way, you're starting to disrupt the flow of prana. You're starting to create movement within mm-hmm. that. And meditation is a point of focus, mm-hmm. a single point of focus where mm-hmm. we can bring all of that movement into a place of stillness mm-hmm. and ground into the body.
And that's really what asana as well, you know, like you're just moving prana around in certain directions, and same as pranayama, that, yeah, there needs to be intention, first of all, of what pranas you're moving in what directions. And then there needs to be this point of focus, this integration of the practice and this direction of prana. So we can guide prana in a specific way or in a specific action or in a specific practice to achieve whatever we're wanting to cultivate.
Mm. Love that.
Mm.
Sounds beautiful.
Yeah. Cool. So as I said, the daily routine, our dinacharya, is something that we can all do to calm vata dosha. Vata dosha is mobile and erratic by nature. And so creating a structure for vata dosha, although if extremely out of balance will feel disgusting, is easily the most stabilizing and grounding and calming thing that you can do. And it's very important, and it's so nice to create you know, a routine or a ritual for yourself. It helps you, you know, move towards the actions you want to take and keeps you, I guess, accountable in life.
And I think that those two words that you've chosen are especially poignant in this relationship with dinacharya.
Mm-hmm.
You said, what did you say?
I don't know.
You said two things, a routine or mm-hmm. a ritual.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks to two specific kinds of people.
Yeah.
That some people thrive on structure
yeah.
and rigid mm-hmm. routine.
Mm-hmm.
And some people thrive on like softness mm-hmm. and devotion, and turning it into a ritual
yeah,
gives that softer experience oh. where it's actually creating relationship as opposed to creating structure.
Yeah, for sure.
It feels like a very masculine and a very feminine pathway towards the same thing.
The same thing. Ah, exactly. And it will suit different people at different times. And yeah, I think you're so right. You know, whatever feels like the most alive experience for you, or something that you feel like you can stick to, whether it is ritualistic based or routine based. Beautiful.
Yeah. And I've also been enjoying the theme that we've been exploring this week
mm-hmm.
around Sankalpa.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, we all have an experience or a life that we're moving towards.
Yeah.
That's buried deep in our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
But deep down, we all know what that lifestyle is that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that dinacharya is like the piecing together of that ideal life, yeah. that life of health and wealth and vitality and vibrancy. And that if we can plan in a very nourishing way, a set of practices, routines and habits that move us toward the life that we want to live, we'll be much better off.
Yeah, for sure.
But it just comes down to sticking to it.
Yeah, 100%. And yeah, I love what you said. Maybe we could do a podcast about Sankalpa and Vikalpa, just a re-enlivened one. I know we've done one in the past, but maybe in a couple of weeks that could be our next one. But yeah, that's kind of what I've been sharing in my classes this week, is just like how we can create this Sankalpa, which can be a feeling-based intention from the heart, like a seed that evolves from the heart. And how, when we start to get more clear on Sankalpa and intention and where we want to move or where we want to cultivate, what we want to cultivate, it becomes easier, the more clear we are, to act from that place. And I think that's what we've got written down kind of here almost, is that Dinacharya can be this practice of Samyoga. And Samyoga is something that moves us towards, or we add to move towards the state of yoga, which is the state of union, the state of, you know, complete peace, of connection and celebration that we're all striving for in the practice of yoga.
Yeah, and the essence of health.
Yeah, and it's the essence of health for sure. And as we move towards it with these actions of Samyoga, you know, that's can be what Dinacharya is. It's like, oh, okay, well, this is my Sankalpa. This is my intention or my goal for the month or for the year, whatever you're working with. And then breaking it down into what actions can I take on a daily basis that actively move me in that direction. And that's where the magic happens, because we can have all the goals or the resolutions or the intentions that we want, but if there's no actions to move us in that direction, then maybe it's not going to happen.
Yeah. And those actions being categorized in diet actions, lifestyle actions, and what is brahmacharya?
Right use of energy.
Yeah.
And also nidra, sleep.
Sleeping.
Yeah. The four pillars of health. Yeah, that's a beautiful point. And just also like rounding up that point is that this concept of svasta, which I'm sure you've heard us talk about before, and it's this establishment or groundedness in our sense of self, and our sense of self meaning our most authentic expression of self. And it also translates as health. And so it's an interesting concept, because it points towards the idea that when we are the most grounded and most established in our true and highest sense of self, then we are able to live a life of health and balance.
Yeah, and that memory of health is stored in the cells, it's stored in the DNA, and that the body knows how to move toward health if it's given the correct conditions.
I love that concept. I think when I learned that, I was just like, whoa, that's mind-blowing. But 100% right. If, you know, all the body like wants you to thrive, and the body wants you to be healthy and vibrant. And so it's not always a matter of adding all these new practices into your life, but instead just removing the causes of what's taking you out of imbalance, what's taking you towards imbalance, sorry. And it can be that simple, that if you just start to put yourself on the right path, the body wants to move in that direction. You're not trying to fight the body. It's a very interesting concept, something maybe I had in my head.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because I think a lot of people that maybe listen to this podcast are on some kind of healing journey. I think most people who practice yoga, pranayama meditation, are interested in Ayurveda, are trying to heal in some way.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to note how quickly healing takes place when you get the conditions right.
I mean, it depends on the circumstances, but yes. It
depends on how chronic the disease is. But if it's something general.
Yes, of course.
Myself just being the example of this, moving from a state where I, you know, couldn't get up to go for a walk. I was 21.
Yeah.
Could walk for 5 minutes, have to sit down. Just so inflamed and overweight. When the conditions were right for my body to start to move back into health, it's a matter of 6, 12, 18 months.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is just incredible.
Yeah,
it's so simple when you can look at it through that lens.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a society, we're a little hung up on magic pills, fixing things overnight is the only issue. And that maybe the 12 to 18 month journey of health is not what somebody wants to hear. But yes, you're 100% right, isn't it? So beautiful that we can move towards that health so easily and so effortlessly with simple actions rather than, you know, and actually treating the root cause of the problem rather than what the Western medical world does most of the time, although the Western medical world is incredibly important for a lot of things. But it treats the symptoms. And so once we treat the symptoms, the chances of that expression of imbalance of dosha arising as another symptom is very common. And so instead, we anchor ourselves in the root cause of the issues, remove the root cause, pacify the doshas, and then from that place, we can move towards health and stay there.
Do you remember that little plant that I left out in the sun and it got sunburnt and lost all its leaves?
No.
It was like one of those climbing monsteras, the little ones. I left it out front, just behind where the camera's set up, and it got incinerated, obliterated by the sun, just like middle of January. And I took it back inside. It had one single leaf that was half burned left. Mm-hmm. I gave it a new pot. Mm-hmm. I gave it some water. Mm-hmm. I gave it some shade. Mm-hmm. And then I left it in that spot and watered it every week for 12 months.
Yeah.
And it came back as bushy as anything.
Yeah, of course.
I think that's the most beautiful analogy for how nature wants to heal.
Yeah, totally.
And that our bodies are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. That it there is space for regeneration.
Yeah, totally.
It's innate. It's innate to us. Mm-hmm. It's part of what our body's designed to do.
Yeah, and I think the issue, well, I mean, we're just going a little deep now, but I think that what is common is that people just give up when they hear a diagnosis. This feeling of, oh, you know, I don't want to fight this, or, you know, and that's the difference is we speak with one of our clients regularly who has quite the diagnosis, and she is just like, I'm not going to let this fight me. And it's that process of not giving up and, you know, knowing that the body will heal itself if you give it the right conditions is what will heal itself.
Yeah. And I think just to bring that full circle is that yoga and Ayurveda as healing practices are designed around you listening to you, like deep in your heart, what feels like the most nourishing thing to do. And that then we build the Dinacharya practice around this.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's continue on with Dinacharya.
All right, cool. Well, I know we've done a previous podcast where we spoke about the times of day, but I'm just going to go over it again because I think it's important. And it's one of those things, the more you hear it, the easier it gels right in.
Sinks in.
Yeah, totally. And so we really create our Dinacharya around the different times of day. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, there's different times of day for different doshas. And so what we do in different times of day will vary on the dosha, but also like any imbalances or disease that's present. And so just knowing that as we go through this is all just general advice and can differ and vary depending on your circumstances, your imbalance, etc. Cool. And so the times of day, we begin our Dinacharya the night before is what we always say. And to implement good quality sleep, it's important that we go to bed before 10 p.m. every night. Hopefully asleep before 10 p.m. every night. So maybe that means bedtime at 9. And basically this is because from 10 p.m. till 2 p.m. it's the pitta stage of evening. And what that means is that if you stay up past 10 p.m. you'll most likely get that second wind of energy of, oh, now I can't get to sleep, and you stay up till about 2 a.m. That's usually how it goes. And also, if you stay up past 10 p.m., instead of the body using this pitta time of evening to heal and to transform the body and nourish the body, it'll instead start to digest your food from the day. And that can be when you, again, get late night munchies if you stay up late and you've digested all your food instead. And ideally, the food is digested before you go to sleep anyway, but it digests more to the fact that you're hungry for more food. And so we want our body to be asleep during this time so our liver can start to process all of the toxins from the day so that we can start to process the mental activities of the day, the thoughts we've thought, the activities we've partaken in, etc., just so we can get this really integrated state of being and a deep, restful sleep. But yeah, being asleep by 10 p.m. is key.
That was a long detour.
Not really.
It was a long explanation.
Yeah, I know, but that's what the podcast is all about.
What time do you get up?
So you should get up before 6 a.m. Every day. And this varies in terms of, you know, daylight savings and stuff like that. But the idea is you get up before the sun rises and or with the sun. And the idea is this, that you, like once it's 6 a.m. or once the sun's up, you're in the kapha stage of day, which is categorized as, you know, like heavy, lethargic, dull, thick, all that kind of stuff. And so if you get up before 6 a.m., you kind of ride on this vata time of day. Between 2 and 6 a.m. is vata stage. And so that means you can wake with the lightness, with the ease of the morning. And it's a beautiful time to partake in practices of spiritual nature, like yoga, asana, pranayama, and meditation.
What does it feel like for you when you don't get up with me at 5 o'clock? Oh my gosh,
it feels terrible. Every time that I convince myself to sleep in, because it's one of my vices, is I just have the worst time ever. I just feel like way less rested than I was if I would have gotten up at 6 a.m. I feel groggy, I feel heavy, and I feel like stagnant is one of the things. And that is just the essence of kapha dosha. And so if that's something you experience and you do have a tendency to sleep in past 6 a.m., I would encourage you to get up and just see what it feels like when you get up.
I think it's one of those things where it's so difficult mentally if you try to get up earlier than you normally would.
Yeah.
But I feel like if you go to bed with the intention of getting up early, and just before you go to sleep, you say to your mind, please wake me up before my alarm at 5:30 a.m. And what that'll do is that when you hear that alarm go off, or just before you hear the alarm go off, your mind will wake you up, your consciousness will return, and you will be alive. You'll be ready to go.
That's a good idea.
I think for me, that's been one of the biggest things is just setting that intention to wake up before the alarm.
Yeah. And also just like putting an alarm on outside of your bedroom is always helpful as well. So you have to get up.
Getting up and out of the bedroom.
Yeah, totally.
And then doing some bustrika or something, heavy breathing.
Yeah, cool. And so once you get up, we start our dinacharya. We start this daily routine. And most of the time you should straight away head to the bathroom sink and scrape your tongue 7 times back to front, one for each of the bodily tissues. And the tongue's a whole different concept, but basically you can read your tongue and notice what's going on with you. If there's any kind of like white coating, there's presence of arm or metabolic toxins, which is quite common, but not something that has to be there permanently once we start to regulate the digestion.
So we scrape it off.
So we scrape it off and get
rid
of it.
It's gluggy and kind of gross. Yeah. But once you do it,
you won't go back.
You won't go back.
Cool. And then from there, there's different practices you can do in different orders. But most of the time, you'll probably have a glass of hot water. Well, brush your teeth and stuff like that. Maybe you have a shower and do that. Or even just neti pot, which is like the cleaning of the nasal passages with this cute little teapot. And you just pour it up one way with some saline water, salty water, and then do it the other way. And this just helps to clean out the nasal passage, clear any sinus congestion, and also just allow better breathing. Cool. And then a nice warm cup of water. You don't need the lemon in it. I know they're telling you that, but
that's not going to make me lose weight.
No. And most of the time, the people that are having the lemon are quite pitta provoked, so just have the warm water. That's cool. You can have the lemon like once a week if you really want it, but just some warm water is more than enough. It will stimulate peristalsis if it hasn't already, which means that you will go and do your first bowel movement of the morning.
It's like tea without the tea.
Yeah,
that's just how I manage
just tea
the hot
without
water.
The tea.
It's tea
I
without
love
tea.
Hot water.
It's coffee without the coffee.
Oh my goodness. Cool. And then from there, we can have some spiritual practice, if you like, or some exercise. And maybe that looks like yoga asana, pranayama, and meditation.
Maybe that looks like going for a run. No, we're not allowed to run in Ayurveda.
That's not true. It's not that we're not allowed to run. But a calm, brisk
maybe
walk
a
in
bicycle
nature
ride.
In nature would be
a bicycle would be
best.
Too vata-inducing.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. Let's
maybe you could walk
it.
With your dog.
Just do something that you enjoy doing.
Yeah, some movement.
Some movement. And then you can do the practice of Abhyanga. And so Abhyanga is this practice of warm oil, self-massage. That really works to calm vata dosha because, again, it moves prana in its directions. And so the subdoshas of vata are the prana vayus, or the prana vatas, meaning that when we're working with the pranas, we're inherently working with vata dosha.
Mm. Okay, and so Abhyanga is massaging yourself with oils. Yeah. I love when people say anointing yeah. themselves. Yeah. Is that the word that you yeah. use?
Denise uses that.
It's an interesting practice. I, in the beginning, found it a little bit weird.
Mm.
I feel like I never really got massages. Paige and I had very different upbringings. Paige had access to massages.
Mm.
Like, she would go to the shopping center. Mm-hmm. Was it always a shopping center?
Oh, my
like,
mom would do it as well.
Or your mom. And she would go to the shopping center, or her mom would give her a massage. How often did this happen?
Don't know.
Once a week?
Yeah, probably.
And I didn't get a massage until I was like in my late teens in Thailand. And it was quite a traumatic experience for me. I found it very, very awkward.
Yeah.
And so I think Paige coming into Abhyanga, it was like a natural thing.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it felt weird mm-hmm. at the beginning.
For sure. And I think it's important to know that... like maybe just putting in here, like dry body brushing is a phenomenon right now that is also very popular. And knowing that dry body brushing is dry and a little bit rough, that it's usually quite rough, the feeling of it, not necessarily your technique, which can be quite aggravating for vata dosha. It can be a beautiful practice for kapha dosha that needs a little bit of roughness and dryness for their, stuck and oily body. in the best way possible. The stagnancy that kapha dosha normally has in the morning. Dry body brushing can be very medicinal. Also can Abhyanga be.
Mm.
But yeah, just putting that point in there, the dry body brushing, just notice what it does. I've never liked it.
All right. You know when it's windy and winter,
mm-hmm.
like that dry Melbourne winter, right mm-hmm. in the beginning of winter before it starts raining too heavy.
Yeah.
It's dry, it's windy, it's cold.
It's rough.
And the first thing that happens is your lips start drying mm-hmm. up.
Yeah.
And what do you put on your lips? Some oil-based lip gloss.
Hopefully not Vaseline.
What's wrong with Vaseline?
It's got petrol in it.
Paige, you can't. They're going to sue us now. We didn't say anything about me. Anyway, so the first thing you do is put some oil-based lip balm on your lips to protect them from the dry, cold wind of winter.
Yes,
and Abhyanga is like this same idea where you are anointing your body.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep using that word. Mm-hmm. But you're putting oil on the body, on the skin, to form a layer of protection against the dry and the cold and the harshness of the world.
And not only that, but you're, the practice of Abhyanga, as long as you leave the oil on for, at least 10 minutes or so, like it starts to deeply penetrate not only the skin, but into the bodily layers of tissues as well.
In yoga therapy, there's this phenomenon where if someone has joint pain, it's just warm sesame oil.
Yeah,
that's
totally
the recommendation every time.
Yeah.
Any kind of joint issue, warm sesame oil, rub it into the joint.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the Tin Man. You have to oil the joints, and mm-hmm. Abhyanga soaks that oil into the tissues mm-hmm. and it lubricates things.
Yeah.
I've always had this thought in my head that aging is drying.
Yeah, totally.
Aging is just drying out.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of the maha practice of anti-aging.
Just
oil rubbing on
totally.
You.
Totally. Yeah, well, as we move into, an older age, we're moving into the vata stage of life. So it just makes sense. You dry up, you shrivel
Speak
up
for
kind
yourself.
Of stuff. Yeah, well, not until you're in your 50s, 60s. but, oiling is medicine. Anyway, so what I was saying
oil is medicine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's not a common thing to think about. Anyway, so just understanding that, dry body brushing can be aggravating, and just noticing how you feel after it. Because for me personally, it's never been something that I enjoyed. I don't have a lot of kapha in my constitution at all. So it does just aggravate my vata for sure. Mm. But when I started practicing Abhyanga, I was like, oh, this is nice. And so, even if you are quite vata, maybe, the dry body brushing is the most prevalent in springtime, when it is that kapha time of year. And using the dry body brushing then, and maybe notice how it moves things for you. But basically, Abhyanga is the same concept of dry body brushing, maybe a little more ancient. I wouldn't want to bet on that, but I'm sure it is.
batting for facts.
None of this information is factual. Yes, so it's the same concept. The concept is we're moving our lymph, which is our rasa dhatu, or these concept of, I'm trying to think of the other word for it, but that's fine. But it's the same concept.
Plasma?
Yeah, there was maybe another one I was thinking of, but that works too. Plasma. And so we want to move it, towards the heart and make sure everything's in circulation. But there's so many other uses for it as well. But some of the concepts of Abhyanga are similar to dry body brushing. So let's begin maybe by just speaking about oil and what kind of oil we should be using, and also whether it should be warm or cold. And so it should almost always be warm, even if it's only gently warmed up. And if you don't have a specific oil burner, no, we're out. That's
you
fine.
Can't buy it from our online store. But maybe
I'm
in the
buy
future.
Some more, yeah.
I would say if you're listening to this in the future and it's, you know, a month or a couple weeks.
Check the website.
Forwards,
it might be there.
Yeah. Check it out.
But yeah, you can buy these specific Abhyanga oil warmers where it kind of looks like one of those like oil diffusers.
Yeah, like the old school candle diffuser.
And so you put a candle underneath and that's the flame, the heat, and then there's a little bowl that sits on top where you can put your oil in. And so it's this just slow and gentle, gradual heating of the oil. And if you don't have that, I usually recommend like a double boiling method where you'll have like a pot of water on the stove, and then just putting like a heatproof bowl on top of it and heating it that way.
But that kind of limits you to getting a massage in your kitchen.
Well, no, I used to do it like that. I used to heat up the oil so it was quite hot and then take it to the bathroom and do it in there, and then it would last most of the time.
Just a pot of hot water?
No, just the bowl.
Oh, okay.
I would take it off the heated pot of water and take it into the bathroom.
I was just imagining doing Abhyanga in the kitchen and how awkward that would be.
No. yeah. You can use it in your bathroom. And so types of oil, there are so many different types of herbal-infused Ayurvedic oils for different ailments, different issues, different imbalances. And, you know, that can usually be recommended by a practitioner, or maybe you can do like a quiz. But you can go to any of the oil suppliers. I quite like Bioveda. That's where most of my oils come from. And usually they'll have a bit of a description under each of the oils. So that can be helpful.
Yeah, shout out Bioveda. We buy a lot of oil from them.
And the other thing to note is that it doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be a special oil. Some of the most commonly used ones we have in, you know, our pantry or the supermarket is a beautiful organic cold pressed sesame oil, not the toasted stuff. You want the good stuff. That might not be hard to find.
The toasted stuff is the good stuff.
Yeah.
But it's a very strong scent and it's not for massaging.
No. You can go to health food shops and easily find that. But any Ayurvedic practitioner or retailer should sell something like that. And so the one thing to note, because sesame oil is the most recommended oil, is that it can be quite heating. So in summer, if there's any like excess heat or irritability around heat, I would avoid sesame oil for sure. But it's a beautiful oil for like autumn and winter, definitely. Those cooler months, and it just heats the body really nicely.
What about, what are some other common oils? Mm-hmm. What about like an almond oil? Is that possible?
I don't really know too much about almond oil. I think I looked it up and it was like warming. I think nuts are warming off the top of my head.
Okay then. And then a coconut oil?
Coconut oil. So especially in the heat of summer, or if you have pitta provocation, it's not necessarily an oil I would take into winter or autumn, even if you do have pitta issues.
I think for me, what always I avoided coconut oil in winter because it would harden.
Yeah.
And it's sesame nature. Oil doesn't harden.
Yeah, totally.
And I always thought that if I put that coconut oil on my skin and then it hardens because it gets cold, my skin will get all locked up. I don't know. It freaked me out. So I stopped.
I guess that's just a reflection of nature, right? But yeah, you're totally right. It's a cooling oil. And so should really only be used in the heat of summer or when there's any excess heat in the body, that's for sure. So that can be a beautiful oil to use. And then also mustard seed oil is a good kapha reducing oil or kapha balancing oil. You can find that at like Indian grocers. I've never really seen it anywhere else, but when I saw it at the Indian shop, I was like, that's the oil.
You were excited. I was.
So that's a good one as well. And then finally, sunflower oil, as long as it's all organic, cold pressed, the best quality oil possible. Sunflower is very neutral, so it can be used for all doshas.
What about ghee?
I don't know about ghee, and I'm younger.
That would be so stinky.
I mean, you can use it in your eyes and stuff.
I remember when you told me to put ghee in my eyes.
I think you would try it and see.
I don't think you would want to be anywhere
like
near
that.
Me.
Yeah.
Because it would be so smelly.
It's pretty strong in smell. But I mean, I've never heard of that, maybe. But you could just use that on like little patches if you need, like if you have any dryness or anything like that.
Rub some ghee into
it.
Better than rubbing dirt into it.
Definitely. Cool. And then so basically the setup of Abhyanga is that you most likely want to put an old towel down because oil stains, if you didn't already know that. It stains the crap out of whatever you use. And I recently just got a special new dressing gown that's my Abhyanga dressing gown, so I'm so excited to use that.
And we've got this manky old towels.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just had special clothes. So yeah, even if you don't have a special dressing gown like me now, you can use like some specific clothes that you don't mind getting oily, and they are just designated into Abhyanga clothes, and that can be really helpful. But basically you want to just set up a nice old towel on the floor, have your warmed up oil, and then there's so many different ways that we can practice Abhyanga.
Yeah, I feel like we've, from everyone that we've learned Abhyanga from,
it's
we've got
different.
A different sequence totally. Of how they do the actual massage.
Yeah, and what was I going to say?
I think for me, as someone who doesn't do a lot of Abhyanga, the thing that's always stuck for me is massaging towards the heart.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And what I was going to say before we start is make sure that the room's quite warm. You don't really want to do it and then be cold. That's not ideal.
Yeah, and if you struggle for, like if you live somewhere cold, it could be that you do a bathroom or some small room and you have like an oil heater or something in there.
Or even by the fireplace. If you have a fireplace, that would be the dream.
Fireplaces are pretty drying though.
Yeah. But so well, heaters.
Yeah, true.
Anyway, so the practice of Abhyanga, there's so many different rituals and routines you can do with the instructions of Abhyanga. Most of the time when somebody asks me, I say, let it be intuitive. because it just depends on what you need. And like Aaron said, the most important thing is there's emphasis towards the heart. And so the strokes are both up and down, but the emphasis is on the upmost.
That you're putting pressure on the upstrokes.
Mm-hmm, more pressure necessarily than the downward strokes. And it doesn't have to be a lot of pressure. And then the other thing is you want, these strokes on limbs, but around the joints. Oops, sorry.
Oh my God.
Similar to dry body brushing, you want circular motions. So around the elbow, around the wrist, around the knees, around the hips, all that kind of stuff. You want these circular motions to really just help lubricate the joints and support the joints and what they're doing.
That was a nice demonstration.
Yeah, if you're not watching the video, sorry. Just hit my microphone.
And you would normally do this without clothes on?
Yeah, I mean, if you can, that would be best. Sometimes when I'm a little bit chilly, I like do it with my dressing gown and do like my bottom half first and then like put my dressing gown over my legs and do my top half. But it's up to you. But normally, you do it in the nude.
Yeah, I think that might have been one of the more awkward parts for me. It was just like being in a bathroom completely naked, lathered in oil, and there's no lock on the door. And I live with my parents.
Fair enough. I mean, you can do it with clothes. I'll probably do a tutorial one day and I'll have to wear clothes. So yeah. I'll let you know how that goes. But yeah, that's the main concepts is you want to have the emphasis on the strokes towards the heart. So basically up towards the heart, if you're on the arms or the legs. And then circular motions around, you can do around the chest as well and also the belly. But I'll go through a bit of a step-by-step now if you like.
I feel like I've got there's an Abhyanga in our YouTube video, Yin Yoga for Self-Love.
Oh, yeah.
There's like a self-massage. It doesn't have oil involved
I
in it.
I could not guarantee that it's any way in shape to Abhyanga. But yeah, you could say that.
But it's nice.
Okay. Anyway, so there's I've learned with a few different practitioners now, and yeah, like Aaron said, there's so many different ways, and it depends on the teacher, it depends on the tradition, it depends on so many different things. The idea is it does all the same stuff, so just try it out and see what works for you and stick with that. The way that I practice Abhyanga in my clients is quite different to the way that I practice on myself, so just know that, yeah, it doesn't have to be the same as that. But there's two practices, self-Abhyanga, that I've tried, and the first I did for quite a while, and it's not the practice I continually do now, but it was a instructional guide, but should I say who it is so that we can add it?
Yeah, we can add it to the resources.
Okay, so the first one is by Vital Veda, and he has an amazing podcast. If you haven't already checked it out, you definitely should, but I'll put the link to his guide here. But basically his guide starts with the head, and then the face, and then the neck, chest, stomach, back, and then you go onto the arms and the hands, and then from there you go onto the thighs, the calves, the feet and the toes. And I believe in his guide he mentions that when you do the limbs, women should do the left first and then the right first for men, on both the arms and the lower limbs, which is interesting. But this is the way I did it for a long period of time. So you would oil the crown of your head first, and interestingly, they say, I get onto that quite a bit, but it's said in Ayurveda that if you don't have time for a complete Abhyanga, the most important places you should do is the crown of your head and the soles of your feet. Very potent mama points and centers in the body. And so even if you've got a short period of time, that's what I would do.
Well, that's where the vata flows from.
And then the other thing to consider is if you have any specific ailments or issues with the body. Like for me, I have a bit of a sore wrist and I have a bit of an stable pelvis, and so they're the areas that I would focus on if I only have 5 or so minutes to do it. But basically this first method is your head, face, and there's some specific instructions, neck, chest, stomach, and in the stomach we always want to do clockwise circles. It's the way that digestion flows, so making sure that's the way that we move. And then the back, and then the arms, the hand, the thighs, the calves, the feet, and the toes. And that's a beautiful practice. I did that one for a really long period of time, and so I quite liked it. And then when I started studying with Hale Pule, their instructions were a little bit different. And the concept is that we're working to calm the 5 prana vayus. And I finally just started to understand this from a logical point of view because I was a little bit stuck. But basically they start around the pelvic area, including the low belly and the pubic bone. Apana vayu, one of the most, potent doshas that go out of balance quite easily, vatas. But massaging around the hips, etc. I use a circular motion on all the joints, specifically the hip joints. And then all the other motions can just be this gentle up and down stroke. And then from there, working down the left leg and foot, and then the right leg and feet. So again, we start with the pelvis and the lower legs. And then from there, you can move to the belly button and you apply the oil again in this clockwise motion.
Samana
vayu. And then you can go in vertical movements around the left side, up towards the chest, and you can always do like circular motions around the chest area as well. I quite enjoy that. And then as much as you can, you do your back as best as possible.
So chest and back is pran vayu.
Pran vayu. And then you move up towards the left shoulder. I like to quite spend a lot of time on my shoulders and my neck. And then you move down the left arm and the left hand.
And arms would be Vyana.
Vyana. And same with the legs. It's like that down and out motion. So working with Vyana Vayu. And then finally you work towards the neck and the face, Udana Vayu. And recently, you know, I just say intuitive around that. But recently I've been doing like a bit of a gua sha routine.
On your face.
Yeah. Ayurveda has this thing called a kanza wand, which I don't have, but I'm looking to get and using that kind of routine. But at the moment I have a gua sha and I've been practicing with that. And I just go on a YouTube tutorial and do these specific motions once I've got the oil applied to my face. And that's been really fun too. And I quite like leaving that to last because it, you know, I spend, 10 to 15 minutes on this like facial and neck massage routine that like all my other oil has kind of like sat on for a specific amount of time.
So luxurious.
Yeah, it is really luxurious. And then, of course, the crown of your head and the scalp as much as you can. Obviously, that doesn't have to be done every time because then you just have oily hair all the time. But when you can, giving your head a good oiling and, you know, that scalp massage really helps to stimulate hair growth and can help with dandruff and all that kind of stuff as well.
I like that. I think that's a cool sequence.
Yeah. So that's the sequence I've been working with currently because, yeah. I inquired that it was different to what I had been on and they just said, try it out and see what works. So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, cool.
But yeah, that's what I currently do. And, you know, it can change every now and then when I just don't remember or whatever. But I think it's just most important to build that relationship with your body and let it be intuitive. There's no right or wrong way to do anything. As long as, you know, you're circling around the joints, there's these gentle up and down strokes focusing towards the heart. And you're using an oil that feels right for your body, then I think that's all good.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. That was a great share. Good work. Lots of information compiled in a very concise way. Do you think
I've missed anything? Like what happens after maybe?
What happens after you have a shower and get the oil off?
Yeah. So basically you want to leave it on for, you know, at least 5 to 10 minutes would be great. So the oil has time to really deeply penetrate into the body. You wouldn't want to sleep with it on. You'd probably leave it on for maybe half an hour to an hour max. And then you want to have a shower afterwards. And a lot of people oil their body after the shower. But the idea is you oil it before the shower. And then you have a shower with no soap. And so you just give it a bit of a rinse and you just allow the excess oil to come off. And also in that process of Abhyanga, you're kind of extracting any like obvious or surface level toxins out of the body with the oil. And so having the shower after that really just helps to eliminate those toxins from the body. And then, yeah, just patting yourself dry as necessary. And your skin shouldn't feel oily, but it should feel like soft and supple.
Yeah,
and
that's the idea. That
yeah, it's that you don't need to oil it afterwards because if you oil it before, even if you have a shower, as long as you don't use soap, you're not really washing it all off. It's the effect of the oil will still be on the skin.
Yeah, it's like a plumpness.
And then my teacher always says that you should pour like boiling hot water down your shower once every so often to make sure no oil is like getting stuck and clogged up.
Very, very good advice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure all the plumbers will thank you for that.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Cool. And that's not something that needs to happen every day.
No. If you're very vata provoked, it can be a beautiful practice to do every day. But, you know, 2 to 3 times a week is amazing.
Once a week is amazing.
Once a month is amazing. It depends. Depends how important it is to you, what your current circumstances are, and like the actions you want to take towards your state of health.
Cool.
Yeah.
Love that.
Cool.
And I think that this is just such a beautiful topic because it's really the essence of everything that we share. Is like, how can we build a set of habits, a set of actions that will move us towards health? We do that through our diet. We do that through our lifestyle. We do that through our yoga and meditation practice. I think it's a good topic. I've had fun talking about this.
Yeah, me too. Shall I finish the rest of the day quickly?
Sure. We're going back to a big timeline.
Yeah.
So what was our original timeline? What time is it right now?
What do you mean?
In the day.
Yeah, like morning, mid-morning. and it depends.
The ideal day. Let's hope you got a day off or you get up early.
Abhyanga can be done whenever you need it to be done. And it can be done at night. It's a beautiful practice to do in the evening as well. If you struggle with sleep, even again, just the little bit of oil on the crown of the head and the soles of the feet and then putting some socks on can be really helpful for sleep as well. But yeah, we're roughly in the morning period of time, and ideally this all happens before 7 a.m. And then between 7 and 8 a.m. is a great time to have breakfast. And it can be a light breakfast. It doesn't have to be.
And so say someone, like it was someone from our community that comes to the 6:30 a.m. practice, would the ideal be that you get up, you do your tongue scrape, hot water, brush teeth, a little bit of Abhyanga, and then get up and go to the studio for practice.
Or you could do it after.
And then you can go to work.
Yeah. Yeah. Either. Whatever works.
Cool.
But yeah, that could be great. And then, yeah, you can come and do your 6:30 a.m. Sol Hatha practice with us.
Or at your local studio or in your living room.
Or in your living room.
But I think that's a nice time to be doing movement.
Oh, it's so good. But yeah, for sure. And then, yeah, between 7 to 8 a.m. is a great time for breakfast. I might just skip over it because I think we can do food in another podcast or multiple podcasts. And then from there, you can, you know, start your day, start to get done whatever you need to get done. Between 10 and 2 p.m. is the pitta time of day. And so there's a little bit of extra heat in this time of the day. And you can channel this as productivity, doing some work. If you find you have a tendency to like overstimulate the mind in terms of productivity, maybe not working during this time could be helpful. And it's also the time of day when the sun is the highest at the sky, which means that your digestion is the strongest. And so it's always advised that your heaviest meal of the day is at this time, usually between 12 and 1 p.m.
Mm.
Cool.
I'm just having a thought about just the way that people's lives are changing in our approach to work,
mm-hmm.
that you give this advice of like you should be doing your work between 10 and 2 p.m., but like, I mean, there's many people that still work 9-to-5 totally. Jobs or all sorts of odd hours.
Yeah.
But I am noticing a huge shift in the amount of people that have more freedom to choose when they work.
Yeah. And I mean, you can choose to schedule. I mean, I would hope that you can choose to schedule your tasks for whatever work job you've got in this 9-to-5 period, depending on the doshas. And so, you know, you can do some more active tasks in the morning to help with that pacifying of kapha dosha. You can do anything that needs a little bit more focus and intention in the pitta time of day. And then anything like creative and nature-based or... because not too like
brainstorming,
not too like mind focus time, just more like whatever time in the vata time of day, which is between 2 and 6.
What about planning? You could do your calendar in the time of the day. It would be grounding.
Maybe. Could be over.
I'll go for a walk.
It depends on people's provocations.
It's just so funny because we give this like very specific ideal daily routine, but so many people live so many different lives.
Yeah, and so many people have so many different imbalances. It just totally depends on what's going on for you. So, yeah. From there, this 2-to-6 time of vata time is a beautiful time of day to be out in nature. Maybe you go for an evening walk. Some kind of spiritual practice could be great. Some light reading.
An afternoon yoga class.
Maybe we'll put one of those on. And then dinner is ideally between 5 and 6 p.m. because you want, you know, 3 to 5 hours between dinner time and when you go to sleep to make sure your food's adequately digested. And then from 6 p.m. you're back in kapha time of night.
And that's where we started.
Yeah, we really want to ride this kapha time of night, which means you don't want to do anything stimulating. You don't want to do a hot, sweaty yoga practice, no matter how many people come in and request it of us. But this is why, because we're in the kapha time of day and we want to ride that wave of kapha and use that start to be heavy and dense and slowness to wind down for a beautiful evening of sleep.
We want to do some yin practice.
Yeah, yin is beautiful.
Relaxing. No screens.
Avoiding overhead lights once the sun has set. And then, yeah, moving into the state of sleep before 10 p.m.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
What a lovely day. That sounds like just a...
I know.
Perfect, ideal day.
And so maybe, like, before we wrap up, how has Dinacharya affected you?
How has it affected me specifically?
Or, like, what is it, like... You know, yeah, I need your whole Dinacharya, but like...
No, but I think from the yogic perspective, I mean, the first thing that really grabbed me from yoga philosophy and the Yoga Sutra was like vritti samskara, chakra, the idea that our thoughts create actions and that thought-action cycle is repetitive in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you're not conscious of that thought-action cycle that repeats on itself day to day, your life is on autopilot.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that was one of the first big concepts that landed in yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And that has translated into this Dinacharya concept.
Yeah.
That, you know, before I really committed to this path and this lifestyle, I would get up late. If I didn't have to work, I would sleep until 10, 11, 12. I would go out drinking. I would do all these things. My phone was next to my bed. And then I wondered why I felt so terrible.
Yeah.
And so since understanding this a little bit deeper and really committing to creating those actions, it's just been a very slow optimization of, like, I know the best way to get myself out of bed in the morning at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's two different alarm clocks, one in the room, one out the room. I know the most efficient way to do my oral hygiene because I'm someone who gets, well, in the past has gotten a lot of fillings and like my teeth are a weak point. So I've got a process for that. My digestive system, I've got a process for that in the morning. I've got some warm water and I've got some herbs and that kind of stuff. And then with my practice, I've come to understand myself in this different way and understand the practices that I need to do. So I lift a few weights in the mornings. I do some pranayama in the mornings and some strong asana in the mornings. And then I've got my work cycles where there's practices that I use in my work day to optimize. One at the moment is just not having social media anywhere near my phone ever. And like I had the habit of picking up my phone that if I could remove the distractions from that, I can be more productive and creative in the work that I do. And similarly with bedtime, like it doesn't matter what you're doing or what anyone else is doing. I am going to bed at 9:30 and I'm taping my mouth shut and I'm going to sleep. And so, yeah, I think for me, it's just been so empowering to have spent the last 6-7 years fine-tuning these daily practices. I'm at a point now where I feel confident in what I do every day, and I feel confident in the fact that it's going to move me in the direction that I want to go. And that's just, it's not always been the case, but I think the most important thing to add is that it's taken me 6 or 7 years to get to that point. It's taken me 6 or 7 years of trial and error of different techniques and different practices and different things and figuring out how they fit for me and my life. And I think that's such a empowering thing to have witnessed within myself, and it's something that I encourage of everyone is taking on only the practices in a way that fits you.
And I think that brings up an important point that we can get overwhelmed with dinacharya, we can get overwhelmed with all the things we need to do, and just starting with one thing and just implementing that one thing into your life and allowing it to integrate seamlessly, and then you can move on to the next thing. But we don't need to add in all these different things at once.
If anything, we probably need to take away some things.
But
maybe you can do a give and take.
A trade.
You trade one bad habit, and we all have bad habits and we know them. You trade one of your bad habits for a good habit.
And that's just where we started. The Samyoga and Viyoga is the Viyoga are the things that move us away from this state of yoga, bad habits, and the things that move us in towards that direction of yoga, which is Samyoga, these good habits.
Good habits.
Yeah, and I think what I really
sounds so funny in English, good habits and bad habits.
Yeah, it sounds weird. I think what I heard from you was the importance of like understanding cause and effect. And it's something that's so important when we speak about Ayurveda, is understanding the effect of the actions that we take. And knowing that every action that we take will have an effect or a thingy.
Yeah, an effect.
Yeah.
It'll do something to you.
Something. Yeah.
It'll change you in some way.
Yeah. And so understanding that the actions that you are taking have an effect on your body, and knowing how to take actions that, you know, produce the effect that you want is powerful and empowering for sure. And I think finally on that, just that this daily routine or dinacharya is space for you. And especially the people that are in relationships, you know, there's often a lot of, you know, intertwining of life, especially for Aaron and I, working and living together. And it can be a lot sometimes, but, you know, making sure that your dinacharya, sure, it can involve your partner in some aspects, but it's the practice for you, and it's tailored to you, and it doesn't have to be something that intertwines with your partner in this way.
Yeah, that you do together even. Yeah. I actually cherish my time doing my practices as space for me to connect to myself.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Cool.
What a great thing to end on.
Yeah.
Well, should we do a little bit more self-promotion?
Yeah.
Just like sandwich it
in
there.
Like this is the ad, so you can't skip it. But please keep listening. We have some very exciting announcements coming up here. We have a India retreat.
Yeah, we're going to India.
And yoga teacher training coming in September and October of this year, 2023. We are so damn excited.
And I think this is such a great community to share that with, because there are people literally all over the world listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
People all over Australia listening to this podcast. We're going to India so that we can all gather together in India.
Yep. So we have a 3-week immersive 200-hour yoga teacher training, which starts September 7th. It aligns quite nicely with Victorian school holidays. Not sure about the other states, but fingers crossed. And then we also have a 7-day yoga and Ayurveda India pilgrimage retreat, which starts on, I believe, the 11th of October. So both these offerings are on our website and you can find all the details. We'll put a link in the show notes, but if it's something that you're interested in, traveling to India with a group of people, and feeling, supported in that, we would absolutely love to have you come.
And it's so beautiful. The place that we are staying is, it's the only place in India that we have ever been that had a pool.
And also relaxing.
Oh my God, it's so relaxing.
Yeah, we've really found the best of the best place, and we're so stoked to take you all over with us. We have quite a few people already signed up and the retreat's definitely filling up a little bit faster. So if it's something you're interested in, please let us know ASAP. Reach out
really
if
wholesome.
You have any questions or anything like that. But we're so damn excited for that.
On February 10th, which is next month, that's actually so close, we're running our yin yoga teacher training. It's 50 hours and we run it in the studio in Berwick over 2 weekends. So it's a beautiful opportunity for dedicated students or yoga teachers to come and have a glimpse into the depths of yin yoga practice. It's really designed to help you to build a self practice. And then if you've already got your 200-hour teaching certificate, you can go and add yin classes to your teaching schedule.
Yeah, totally.
But it's a beautiful course. It's every time we run it, just so nourishing and so spacious. And we get that opportunity to sit in stillness and be introspective. So that's coming up as well.
Cool, that's exciting. And then we also have our online 100-hour Hatha yoga training course, which is live on our website right now. So if you're already a yoga teacher and you want to add our style of practice to your repertoire, or if you're just interested in starting to dive deeper into the practice of Hatha yoga that we teach, and also some philosophy and anatomy, then you can jump online right now and check it out. There's some payment plans available and it's all pre-recorded on the website, so you can literally start now and move at your own pace.
I highly recommend that training. I obsessed over the content for months on end. And I think it came out really well.
Yeah, and we did it as a live format training. So we had some people in the room, which is how we generally work best. And so it really adds that liveness to the training, as if you're sitting in the room with us.
Yeah.
So yeah, check it out. And if you have any questions, let us know. But each module of the training, there's four. You get like a one-on-one chat with Aaron afterwards to discuss any questions and stuff like that. So it's super practical and it's registered with Yoga Alliance. I think they're letting us still do online courses till the end of the year. So if you're a yoga teacher, you can add it to your continuing education points.
The final offering that we have is our online studio, which is a library that holds our most potent practices in the video form. So it's basically just a library that you can go to. You can have instructions on Hatha yoga, on pranayama, on meditation, and there's a few different workshops and stuff in there. We're looking at revamping the online studio in the new year.
It's going to take a few months. But
yeah, we just haven't quite got there yet. We're starting to build the bones of something new.
Yeah.
And we're very excited about it, but we can't tell you anything about that just yet.
But if you're interested to get on now while it's still this price and et cetera, et cetera, then I would highly suggest jumping in and checking it out. There's heaps of great practices in there, over 200 exactly.
And finally, because you've gotten this far, I want to thank you personally for listening to the podcast, listening to us ramble about yoga and Ayurveda. And I just have one thing to ask for this hour of entertainment that we've just provided, is that you share it with someone. Get out your phone right now, press the button next to the episode that says share, mm-hmm. and then pick one person and share it with that person.
Or your Instagram story. We love seeing it being shared on Instagram. That you can do that through that button.
Or on
as well.
Facebook.
Or on Facebook.
I don't know if anyone posts on Facebook, but you could do that. On Twitter. I don't know if we've affected Twitter yet. Anyway, that is the end of our episode. We love you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you want to stay updated, you know where you can find us: Instagram, Facebook, etc. It's all omsom.yoga, including our website. We do run our small, not really small anymore. I don't know why that's there.
It's getting bigger.
It's not small. It's a community-based yoga studio in Berwick in Victoria, Australia, where we run classes, workshops, yoga teacher trainings, all from this space. And we'd absolutely love to connect with you. And meet you.
Totally.
Howdy. Om.